Good afternoon. My name is Mariama, and I will be your conference facilitator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Electronic Visit Verification EVV Stakeholder Open Door Forum. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Jill Darling, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Mariama. Good morning and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for the stakeholder call. Before we get into today's presentation, I have one brief announcement. This open door forum is not intended for the press, and the remarks are not considered on the record. If you are a member of the press, you may listen in, but please refrain from asking questions during the Q&A portion of the call. If you have any inquiries, please contact CMS at press@cms.hhs.gov.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Nardone, and on behalf of CMS, I'd like to welcome you to the stakeholder call on electronic visit verification implementation. I'm the director of the Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group in the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services. We greatly appreciate this opportunity to hear from you as implementation activities continue to move forward. CMS is holding this call today in response to congressional language indicating that CMS should have a forum for EVV stakeholder engagement this year. This language is found in H.R. 6042, which was signed into law this summer, and extended the timeline for EVV implementation in Medicaid-funded personal care services from January 1, 2019 to January 1, 2020. Since the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act, CMS has been engaged with a wide variety of stakeholders to understand their priorities and concerns associated with EVV usage, and we view this conversation as another opportunity to continue that dialogue. With me here today are a few members of the team overseeing EVV implementation. I'll let them introduce themselves throughout the call, but right now I'm going to turn the call over to Melissa Harris, who will walk through a few logistical steps. And I just want to end by, again, expressing my thanks for your participation on today's call and your assistance in helping understand where questions and concerns remain. So thank you very much, and Melissa, take it away.
Thanks, Mike. So let's go over quickly the structure for today's call. We do want to hear from you, your concerns and your feedback regarding implementation of EVV to help us shape the next steps for CMS. We had asked in the advertisement for this call that anyone who wanted to submit feedback in advance of the call could do so over the EVV mailbox, and we received over emails in advance of today's call, and so what we'll do next is go over the major themes of the comments that we received from a wide group of you, from providers, beneficiaries, vendors, states, plans, etc. And then after that, we will open it up for a discussion, both questions and answers, a time for you to share comments. We've got a lot of people on the line today, and so in order to be respectful of everyone's time, we ask that you keep your comments to no more than 3 minutes each. We did receive through the mailbox a couple of requests to make all emails that we received in advance of today's call public. We do want to address that. Hang on one second. We're getting an email that folks are having trouble hearing us. Let's just take a pause and make sure we're okay logistically. Okay, thanks for that. We wanted to make sure we were on the right page logistically. So, like I was saying, we did get some questions submitted to us about whether or not we could share the emails that we received in advance of the call. We are hesitant to do that. We don't have plans to do that at this time for two reasons. One being that we did not say to people in advance that there was a chance that we would share what they submitted publicly. And number two, there were some, in some cases, some quite personal information that was submitted to us to illustrate some questions and concerns around EDD. We don't think it's really appropriate to share those publicly, but we do take your we did take that question into account. One of the our practice has been for questions that we received into the mailbox to provide individual responses. Given the volume that we got in advance of today's call, it is not our intention at this moment to provide individual responses back to all of your submissions. Certainly your comments and your feedback will be taken into account as we are determining next steps for CMS. However, if you would like a formal and individual response back to your question, if you would please resubmit it to the mailbox, and then we will know that that is a question that we do need to provide an individual response to. Also note that we received several questions that are really more answerable from the state, and the answer will depend on the specific system that a state is implementing and some other state-level decisions. And so we will recommend to you that any kind of state-specific questions be addressed to the state Medicaid agency, as they are in a better position than CMS to answer those questions. So, you know, the mailbox has been in existence for some time and will remain in existence. And so please continue to use that as a forum for submitting any questions or concerns. And again, that mailbox is evv@cms.hhs.gov. And again, if you would like a response to a question that you submitted in advance of today's call, the mailbox is still open. So we have gotten a couple of emails, even as we've started, that a lot of people are on hold. That is, I think, a testament to the number of people who are trying to get in. So people are in various stages of speaking with operators, and so we will try to get those folks in as much as we can. So if anybody is hearing this and is in communication with people who are waiting, if you could just let them know that they will be processed in through the operators as soon as possible. We will also take this opportunity to say that there will be, for 2 days after this call, a transcript of this phone call. So for people who have missed a few minutes, people have missed a few minutes, you know, that information will be available. So we'll reiterate all of the logistical issues at the end of the call. So we appreciate people's patience coming in. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kenya Cantwell, and she is going to walk through some basics of the Cures Act language, and then we'll head into the topics that we received on the mailbox. So Kenya, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, Melissa. This is Kenya Cantwell, and as Melissa mentioned, I'm going to provide just a quick overview of the EVV legislation and requirements. So in 2016, the 21st Century Cures Act was signed into law, and it included a requirement that states must implement electronic visit verification for Medicaid personal care services and home health services. EVV refers to technology that electronically verifies that services are delivered at the right time, to the right place, and to the right person. Typically, caregivers or providers check in at the start of the service and check out at the end of the service using a mobile app on a phone or tablet or via the beneficiary's telephone. Under the new law, states are required to use EVV to verify the type of service performed, the person receiving the service, the date of the service, location of the service, the individual providing the service, the time the service begins and ends, and this is for personal care services and, again, for home health services. The purpose of EVV is to ensure that beneficiaries receive their expected care. It's also used to enhance program integrity. It's helpful with reducing billing errors and mitigate potential fraud, waste, and abuse. States are required to implement EVV for personal care by January 1st, 2020, and January 1, 2023 for home health services, unless they have been granted a good faith effort exemption. So that's just a brief overview of electronic verification visit requirements. I am now going to turn it over to Ralph Lawler and Ryan Shanahan to provide a summary of the themes that we received via email prior to this call. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenya. So this is Ralph Lawler, and the first thing I want to do is welcome all the people who came on between the time we started and now, and to let you know that this recording will be available on CORE for a two-day period, and there will be a transcript available. So you have come in at the right time in the call. The other things you can pick up in that on-call recording or in the transcript. The important thing now is for you to hear the summary of what we've heard to date and then to be able to align yourself with your comments. With that being said, I'm going to ask Ryan to give you the major themes that we saw in the input that we've received to date through the mailbox for this call.
Sure. Thanks, Ralph. So as Melissa mentioned, we received over 200 emails in the lead up for today's call, and we organized those into some themes, and we would like to provide a high-level CMS response to each of those themes. So the first theme was general opposition to the EVV statute, where respondents commonly cited discrimination or civil rights issues, including concerns around Olmstead, the ADA and the Fourth Amendment. Respondents also cited intrusion and invasion of privacy concerns, as well as concerns regarding EVV in the context of self-direction and the practicality of EVV in that context. They also cited provider burdens and burdens on beneficiaries and the relationship of that to access to care, and just a lack of evidence supporting EVV as well.
So while CMS recognizes and acknowledges that these concerns are serious concerns and not to be taken lightly, CMS does have a responsibility to implement the laws passed by Congress. As mentioned previously, EVV requirements were included in the 21st Century Cures Act. Any changes to those requirements would require an act of Congress.
So next, we received a number of emails in support for the National Center for Independent Living Principles and Goals, that are otherwise known as NCIL, and they shared multiple concerns, such as those related to privacy and Olmstead, impact on providers, concerns around the use of GPS and data protection, and they also requested more opportunities for stakeholder engagement and greater oversight of state stakeholder engagement.
So we're reviewing the feedback. We'll take that into account as we develop the next step for technical assistance around EVV. So we appreciate the comments and are, in fact, taking that into consideration and incorporating into our process.
Next, respondents expressed concerns around costs and administrative burdens associated with EVV use, particularly for providers of personal care and home health care services. This included concerns regarding administrative cost burdens for providers and beneficiaries and the impact this may have on the provider pool, challenges associated with using multiple systems, requests for guidance on methods states can use for reimbursing EVV costs, for example, for devices or training, state obligations for offsetting EVV costs, and requests for more guidance on enhanced or regular federal matching funds.
So as we indicated in the EDD guidance that was released in May, states may apply for federal financial participation for expenditures and receive an enhanced 90% federal match for the design, development, or installation of an EDD system, and 75% match for the operation and maintenance of the system. States should seek this enhanced federal financial participation through the advanced planning document process. Training of employees on the EDD system can be reimbursed at 75% per the SMD 16004. However, this does not include training for providers or beneficiaries on the use of the system. Trainings for providers and beneficiaries may be claimed at the regular 50% administrative rate, and that can be done in several ways, including it as part of the state's rate methodology for a service. While CMS does not have the authority to provide federal match at any level for costs for providers or individuals, for devices and tablets or things of that nature, costs associated with purchase of devices and/or equipment could be built into the rate paid to the provider for rendering the service. States are encouraged to talk with your RO lead for more details on this. We will be able to give you assistance there.
Our next theme is with regards to implications for self-direction. This included a request to exempt EBB use in self-direction, the need for more guidance around tracking community locations and ensuring privacy, ensuring flexibility and consumer control to accommodate changes in needs and preferences, such as options beyond pre-scheduled locations and the option to allow for multiple delivery locations in a visit, as well as challenges faced by providers of self-directed services.
So we need to start with the basic fact that CMS does not have the authority to circumvent congressional action. And then we would say that the EDD statute does not provide CMS with the authority to exempt self-directed programs from EBB requirements. CMS acknowledges that EBB and self-direction should avoid rigid scheduling rules and be able to accommodate services at multiple locations in order to preserve the flexibility of self-directed services.
Next, we received a number of questions for clarification on the scope of services. This included concerns of CMS's interpretation of the statute and requests for more clarity on which services are covered, such as adult foster homes, shared living, host homes, or other 24/7 living arrangements, day services, and congregate residential services. There's also requests for more guidance around services that begin in the home and end in the community or vice versa.
So while CMS guidance indicates that states are not required to use EDD in congregate care settings or personal care services that occur entirely outside of the home, for instance, day services, it does not prohibit states from using EDD in those settings if they wish to do so. In general, EDD applies to personal care services offered under the different Medicaid coverage categories listed in the Cures Act statute. CMS will not be providing an exhaustive list of services that must be covered by the EBB, as states use varying titles and different definitions for services that include assistance with ADLs and IADLs. We'd advise that you follow up with your state to share those concerns. The definition for adult foster care and shared living, for instance, varies widely across states. Therefore, CMS reviews these at state requests on a case-by-case basis to determine EBB applicability. CMS is also exploring potential guidance for further clarification around services that begin in the home and end in the community, or begin in the community and end in the home.
Our next theme involves GPS and other technologies and concerns associated with their use. This included requests for CMS guidance on the location requirement of the Cures Act and on the use of GPS. Requests prohibit GPS and other technologies concerns with states' interpretation of CMS requirements to mean that GPS is required, and requests for any alternatives to GPS.
So we're exploring alternate methods for verifying the location requirements of the EBD statute, but we need to be clear about the fact that we cannot prohibit states from using GPS.
The next theme was with regard to determining adequate stakeholder input, including a request for CMS to delineate requirements for adequate stakeholder input, and that CMS to monitor state stakeholder engagement. Concerns regarding state's level of stakeholder input to date, and the need for better provider engagement within that stakeholder input, as well as more opportunities from CMS for stakeholder engagement.
So CMS will absolutely assess stakeholder engagement efforts as part of their APD, the Advanced Planning Document, and their good faith effort submissions. We strongly encourage states to follow the promising practices and strategies outlined in the May 2018 CMS Informational Bulletin. CMS will reach out to states to discuss concerns raised by beneficiaries as needed, and we will consider opportunities for future stakeholder engagement on the national level. However, we remain available to listen to stakeholder concerns on smaller scales as well.
The next thing was with regards to the applicability of EVP to beneficiaries with live-in caregivers. This included complications using EVP in family homes, requests to exempt live-in caregivers, for example, because such scenarios do not constitute an in-home visit, was one of the reasons posited, and requests for clarification from CMS on whether live-in caregivers are included in the EVP statute.
So we understand the basis for the question, and we understand the concerns regarding it. We continue to discuss this issue internally to see what leeway there is.
Next, we heard concerns with regards to EVV in rural areas or areas with limited connectivity and how EVV can be used in those situations.
Most EVV technology allows for stored forwarding or batch forwarding of check-in and check-out data when there is no connectivity. The worker enters the information into the EVV interface. That data is uploaded into the EVV system once the connection is reestablished. So if you look at the guidance that we've given you, in particular, you'll see some examples of where states have addressed this in frontier areas.
And next was a theme on guidance on ensuring data protection and HIPAA compliance.
So the CARES Act specifies that EVV systems must be compliant with HIPAA security and privacy requirements. This means that the EVV data must be protected like any other Medicaid or personal health information data. We advise you to follow up with your state's HIPAA compliance officer for more details on what protections are in place in your particular state. You could also visit www.hhs.gov/HIPAA for more information on this matter.
Next was a theme around ensuring EVV can accommodate various individual limitations, so ensuring EVV systems are accessible for all, regardless of language, disability, et cetera.
So we certainly share these concerns. We encourage individuals to reach out to their provider or state Medicaid agency with any questions on how the EVV system will accommodate those needs.
Next, we saw a theme around requests for further guidance or regulations from CMS, including such things as requirements for EVVs, guidance to ensure states do not overreach, guidance on exceptions or corrections in other areas, and I think CMS will explore these as needed. We also saw a request for best practices, and we recommend referring to the EVV website for current promising practices. That's available on Medicaid.gov, and we will issue further TA resources as necessary. And that applies to state expectations for training, outreach, and education. We recommended a number of strategies with regard to training, outreach, and education in our informational bulletin. So we encourage states use those strategies to the greatest extent possible. We also heard concerns regarding how EBV compliance will be assessed, issues with EBV technology, and ensuring a smooth EBV rollout.
So we note that the state may set an error rate with the provider when they are learning the system that allows flexibility during the learning process. We also recommend following strategies for piloting that were outlined in the informational bulletin, if the timeline permits that. CMS plans to share details on how it will assess state compliance with EBV requirements in the near future.
It was also proposed to use EHRs, so electronic health records, or web-based timesheets with dual authentication in lieu of EBV.
Any of those systems would need to comply with the statute and be able to electronically verify the six required data elements in order to be used for this purpose.
And we also heard concerns regarding the Fair Labor Standards Act and Department of Labor implications, including with things like joint employment and clarification on whether an individual volunteering as an employer is defined as a provider.
And while we'll explore this further, we really do advise that the state and individuals in the state reach out to the state to consult with its state attorneys regarding the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Department of Labor issues. Okay. We can now move to the period of questions and answers and stakeholder input. In order to ask a question or make a statement, please dial
#1.
And depending on the issues raised, CMS may not have a formal answer to your question at this time. If that is the case, we'll ask you to submit that question to the EBV mailbox to facilitate a response. As a reminder, please limit your comments to no more than 3 minutes.
Please open the lines for Q&A, please.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Please limit your question to one question and one follow-up to allow other participants time for questions. If you require any further follow-up, you may press star one again to rejoin the queue. Your first question comes from the line of Gina Brady. Your line is open.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Gaylon Toodle. Your line is open.
I think I hit the wrong button too, ma'am. I have no question right now. Hello?
Your
Hello?
Next question comes from the line of Jared Schneider. Your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to verify that a neutral aggregation system and validator would qualify fully for the matching funding for a state if they choose to use an aggregation system and let the providers choose an EBV provider?
The answer to that would be yes, but certainly we would say to include it in the APD application so that you get a clear answer.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Kendra Scalia. Your line is open.
Yes, I'm wondering if CMS has been following the California Department of Social Services EBV web portal that they have been creating in conjunction with their consumer and provider advocates. It is one that I consider to be a model for the nation, especially considering consumer-directed services and the uniqueness of that program. And I'm also further wondering if CMS is going to consider this California EBV system as a recommended model to the nation.
We are reviewing the California system and have had some interest in it internally. We will be exploring that. Thank you for pointing that out.
Your next question comes from Kathy Keith. Your line is open.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to ask a question regarding personal support workers that live with their disabled adult child. We're on self-directed programs, and I live with my son, so if I punched in and let the clock run to all the hours that are budgeted are consumed and then punch out, would that be doable based on the fact that you don't pay any taxes under the 2014-7 exemption anyway?
I think that is a question that really needs to be asked of your state and how they are setting up the process for verification. It sounds like a reasonable question and request, but I would definitely reach out to your state. States will be setting up these systems differently. It also, the state may reach back out to CMS, and there will be factors like whether the rate is per diem, whether it is considered an in-home visit. So there are several complicating factors there that we would need to discuss. So we are looking to be as accommodating as we can within the structure of the Cures Act. So we would recommend an initial reach out to the state, and then the state will follow up with us if they have further questions.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure because in actuality, we don't have to do time and a half in overtime. So to do the EVV system is kind of ridiculous. We live with our adult disabled person. We're with them 24/7.
We really do understand your concerns and really are looking into that with regard to the leeway we have within the statute. Melissa, did you want to say something there?
Yes, thanks. You know, when we issued our guidance over the summer around congregate settings and the fact that congregate settings that used a per diem reimbursement method and used shift work were exempted from the EVV requirements, we got a lot of follow-up questions saying, does that same premise apply to this model and that model? And it became quite clear that we really couldn't opine, you know, without having a conversation with the state to understand the nuts and bolts of that particular program. In the same vein, we've gotten several questions, and you may have heard Ryan mention it as kind of a theme in some of the mailbox feedback we got, asking about whether individuals who live with their caregivers and are receiving Medicaid-funded personal care or home health could also be exempt from EVV. And so similarly, it's pretty difficult for us to say a blanket yes or no without understanding a little more about the variation that exists within some of these models. It is very much on our radar screen that is a question, and we've had stakeholders point out some of the rough edges that you know need to be addressed if EVV were to apply. So we are continuing to pull those threads, and while we don't have a formal answer today, it's very much something that we know we need to address. So thanks for that.
So you're saying that you don't have an answer as of yet whether or not those individuals could be exempt?
That's right. We have been, okay. The question was to us in a few cases, and we don't have anything confirmed in terms of understanding what kind of feasibility the agency has in making a similar exemption as we did for congregate settings, but it's something we continue to pursue.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Lisa Cooley with UC Davis. Your line is open.
How would EVV be implemented in states that have self-directed services, such as California potentially or Oregon?
I don't think that there is a simple answer for that. It depends on how the state itself devises the system and grows the system. We've urged the states to take a close look at the recommendations regarding how to adjust EVV for a self-directed program. In our conversations with a number of states, we found them to be considerate of and respectful of their self-directed programs. So we believe that they will be taking that into consideration, but the structure of this specific program depends on the system the state is using and how they are using it. So I can't give you a simple answer to that. I think the bigger question would be best posed to your state itself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Bill Clark with Department Vermont Health. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned earlier that you're not quite prepared to discuss all of the exceptions to the EVV process at this point, but I just wanted to stress that I think that's the guidance most states are really looking for right now. Following a typical EVV process seems like it's pretty clear and easy for most of us. We understand what that would look like, but it's those exceptions that are causing most of us to worry. And I just wanted to stress that that's the guidance I think we really need from CMS now. So specifically for the self-directed programs, some providers and members don't have access to smartphones or telephone lines or other technology typically used by EVV systems. The question to CMS is, are you advising states to deny services to individuals in these circumstances?
No, we certainly are not directing or urging a state to deny services to anybody. In fact, there are implications for denying services to individuals when you have a documented need. What we are urging states to do is to ensure that they are rendering services in a manner that allows for the collection of the 6 data points that are required by congressional action to satisfy the EVV requirement. That is the area that we have to stay within while we work with states and others to ensure that individuals do continue to receive services. With regard to your other statement about further clarification on the nuances, we understand that. We understand that, and particularly after we got the guidance out on the congregate living settings, that we received a number of calls regarding shared living, where the individual lives with the provider of services, or the provider of services lives with the individual. That is on our radar, and we are looking at that. But I really have to tell you, we've had calls from any number of states recently, and their services and delivery systems are so nuanced that in some cases, one licensure covers everything from congregate living settings that are 24/7 per diem to simply somebody going into the home 8 hours per week to render services. So it is more complex than in some cases a simple answer that is given on a national basis can satisfy. So where you have those complexities, we urge you to reach out to us. We will tell you if it's something we're working on for national information, but we will also consider your specific situation when you ask those questions.
This is Melissa. What I would add on your second point about the instances in which beneficiaries may not have technology, you know, that is something that we did hear several times on over the course of all of our conversations around EVV implementation. We certainly heard those concerns reiterated in the feedback submitted in advance of this call. And we don't associate that as being limited to just self-directed programs. That really could happen in any state based on internet connectivity, whether the individual already has a cell phone in the home. In the informational bulletin that we released, we tried to walk through some technology options that would not rely on a piece of technology already being present in the beneficiary's home. So such as a tablet being distributed to the personal care provider that they would bring into the home of the individual. And so those options exist. It's concerning when we hear assertions that beneficiaries are being asked to pay for things like new cell phones or landlines or some kind of technology, because certainly the one of the first things that evokes is a financial outlay that may or may not be quite difficult for someone to absorb. So, you know, we certainly encourage states and providers and vendors to be cognizant of the fact that depending on the individual circumstance, there will be a difference in available technology, availability of cell phone signals, internet signals, et cetera, and to make their selections of the type of systems to be used with that in mind, that the technology may need to be brought into the home instead of relying on it being there already. And so we're certainly available to help kind of parse through all of those variables with the information that we've collected so far on implementation options. But we do acknowledge that those concerns, you know, really are national in their potential scope.
And recognize in our initial discussion that we've given you some areas where federal financial participation would assist with some of that technology if it's built in correctly into rates or an ABD.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And just a very brief follow-up, if I can. When you when we go through CMS certification for these systems once they're all in place, are we going to be given like a green light status saying that your systems are compliant with the 21st Century Cures Act, or will there be an additional requirement that every single claim submitted for personal care services be linked to specific EVV data that's collected? Is it the system that you're looking for compliance with, that we have overall compliant EVV systems, or is it every single individual claim, or is it both? And I think this really speaks to the exception process, is the idea that we should have a robust EVV system, but there may be a couple of cases where exceptions occur, or is the expectation that 100% of all claims for personal care services be matched to EVV data, or else we can't claim the full match for that claim?
Good question, and what I would say to you is a couple things. Number one, I'd ask you to put the question in the mailbox because our experts on APD are not able to weigh in this room at this time, but I will also tell you that we expect states to have an acceptable error rate policy and to have some kind of exceptions policy for where they can verify that the service was rendered, but there was some breakdown in the system or in the appliance that was recording. So we recognize that. You just need a clear policy on it.
That's great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Your next question comes from Colleen Starkloff with Starkloff Disability. Your line is open.
Yes, my name is Steve, and I am a quadriplegic and consumer of consumer-directed services, and I have transportation time allotted to me. And many times when my worker drives me to the store or to get my car fixed, we do not get back in time for my allotted time to be completed. Is there an allowance for that?
I think that is something that would have to be discussed with the state. Pure transportation without personal care services being rendered during that time frame, if the state has a transportation service, that would not necessarily be caught up in EV at all unless the state determined that they were going to do that type of activity or fiscal oversight of that service. If I've missed your question, I'd ask, offer you time to clarify because I'm not sure I got it or not.
All I was wondering is if I get extra time for patients and we're not able to work or night or not able to some time to I gotta be penalized.
I think that I think even as you're saying that, that it's clear that you need a discussion with the state specifically about transportation unless your transportation was blended with personal care services. It doesn't sound like that is necessarily the case at all, but I'd be having a conversation with my state regarding that.
This is Melissa, and certainly the purpose of EBV is not to negatively influence how
mm-hmm.
services are provided or the scope of services or the amount of time that you're allotted for services. And so I think that the logistical issues will be how to capture the information that is required to be entered into the electronic system, depending on the variety of activities that you might have going on in a particular visit. And so if you are receiving personal care services in your home and then you and your worker, you know, leave the home to go to the grocery store or go to the to get your car repaired or whatever, and you get personal care services as part of your transportation, personal care services while you're in the community, if those services are linked to services that are provided in your home, then that visit might be captured under EBV, but the point of it is to just capture the specific information that's required in the legislation on around when the service started or stopped, where it was provided, who provided it to you. The intention certainly is not to limit the actual provision of care, but as Ralph said, you'll want to talk to not only your state, but you know, your providers, the people who are explaining the technology to you, to make sure that everybody's on the same page with how the various data elements will be captured so that they are not infringing on, you know, your receipt of the actual services.
This is Colleen Starkloff. We're all on this call together at the Institute. And I'm very concerned as I listen to this call about people with disabilities not getting the services they need, interpretation that states might make, but for example, say that transportation is when people with many people with disabilities are very dependent on that kind of assistance from their attendants. And I'm also concerned that states, as they set these programs up, are going to be confused, and you're going to have consumers that will be losing services, and they'll lose their attendants if their attendants don't get paid. I'm extremely concerned about this.
We hear and register those concerns. They certainly are forefront in our minds as we're reviewing advanced planning documents and as we're reviewing with states as they reach out to us how they're implementing the system. I think that in within Medicaid, there is the requirement that you that the service be rendered with respect to in a manner that respects the individual's health and welfare. And again, in at least some of these cases, the services are rendered as part of a documented plan of care that demonstrates through an assessment tool a need. So simply shutting off the service would not be an acceptable response in any way, shape, or form. But we hear and register your concern, and we'll continue to work with that in mind.
And this is Melissa. You know, part of the clarity that we can provide through this call and some other guidance is to articulate the kinds of decisions that have been made legislatively, the kinds of decisions that CMS can be making, and then the kinds of decisions that states can be making. So it's clear, you know, who really is in the driver's seat with the parameters of how EBV implementation is being rolled out. That is not to to try to redirect you to someone else, but there are so many cases in this, as there is really in all aspects of Medicaid, that are going to be very state-specific, and CMS may or may not have any kind of ability to shape the types of decisions that are made at state level. So, you know, part of our responsibility is to continue to articulate the kinds of decisions that CMS has oversight of and has the ability, the structural ability to influence, and then the types of decisions that really rest at the state level. And, you know, so you can understand really who to most primarily address your concern to. But we appreciate hearing those concerns, we'll do our best to articulate who's in the best position to respond to them.
And I think we can clarify for everybody on the line that EDV is not an assessment tool for how individuals receive services or the amount, duration, scope, or frequency of services that are rendered. Assessment tools are an entirely separate issue, and they determine the need, and they determine the amount, duration, and scope, not EVV.
Well, this is Colleen Starkloff. I'll just make this parting comment that I feel like trying to regulate the lives of people with disabilities using some kind of a legislative mandate and a federal set of guidelines doesn't match up to how people actually live their lives every day. And I worry about there being lack of flexibility and understanding. If you get sick, you know, and you can't go to work and you need more hours, how does that get managed? I'm very, very worried. My husband was quadriplegic. We were together 37 years, and this system would have been damaging to him. But I'll stop.
We will simply say we've heard and understood your concerns. One of the things that we open with is that there are some actions that we are not going to be able to respond to or concerns because they will have to be responded to. Those changes would have to be made at a congressional level. So that being said, we really do appreciate your comments and understand them.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Susan Malloy with Arizona SILC. Your line is open.
Hello, thank you. I'd like to make clear I'm not here representing Silk right now. I am a Silk member. I do have some concerns about implementation of this program. I work primarily with people who have been excluded from society because of electrical and chemical hypersensitivities. And many of us do qualify for services at home and caregiving, help with chores and so forth. But we have an awkward access problem. At least it will be awkward for you. Some of the folks with this kind of disability live in tents in remote areas, and that's in order to avoid contact or exposure to any smart meters or to the 4G and 5G electronic equipment, car fumes, factory emissions, things like that. Sometimes our caregivers can't come in our houses. Sometimes they'll come 100 feet toward us, and we'll make our way 100 feet toward them, but it's an atypical situation. We don't have someone who can open the door and let a social worker with EVV equipment come in. We've had also beneficiaries are unlikely to have a cell phone or any other technologies, unlikely to have cell reception. Cell reception is the reason that people move to remote places in the first place, trying to get away from things like that. Our not having cell phones isn't necessarily due to our finances. It's due to our safety. I'd like to mention that I very much appreciate the comments made by Mr. Parks and by Colleen Starkloff about that some of the provisions of the EVV implementation are going to result in denial of services. I think that's very much the case for us. And when you say that if someone has a documented need, that we will be given some kind of access, that doesn't make any sense at all. In our state, at least in Arizona, in other places I've lived, the state agencies have no concept at all of what environmental hypersensitivities means. We can't interact with them because they won't come to us, and we can't go to them in the urban areas. This is preposterous to think that just because Medicaid requires accessibility to services that they'll be in any way available to us. And overall, I'm just extremely concerned about that aspect. I don't think that the state can be counted on to define our access and safety requirements, and so the effect will be excluding us from any kind of home care. Thank you.
We would urge you to send that question to the mailbox and to copy your state on that question, because I think that it is a question that really needs a state-specific answer in how they account for that in their EBD system. But please send it in.
Sir, I've contacted our state repeatedly with very poor results.
Okay. Again, we would urge you not just to send it to your state, but to send it to the EBD mailbox. We'll look into the issue.
The federal EBD mailbox.
Right. Right. And you know, CMS, we can have conversations with the state as well to figure out how they are, what kind of models of care they're using to provide services right now, and how those models, you know, can accommodate an EBD overlay and things like that. So it'll be helpful for us to be able to have those conversations with the state, but take us up on our offer to provide a little more context, you know, for the situation you're describing, and then we'll go from there.
What's the best way to use the federal mailbox?
You mail the question to
evv@cms.hhs.gov.
Okay, evv@cms.hhs.gov. V-O-V.
G as in government. G-O-V.
Thank you. I will try to make my way to a computer somehow and see what I can do about that. Part of the reason you don't hear a lot from people with this kind of disability is that more frequently than not, computers make us very sick, and we haven't had much success requesting of the computer builders and designers that they shield the electromagnetic field and Wi-Fi emissions from this kind of equipment.
Perhaps your personal candidate could assist with that, so we need to move on, but thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Julie Shaw with Creator Services. Your line is open.
Yes, my concern was voiced with the lack of internet or cell service in rural areas. Thank you.
Again, I urge you to go to information that we published in May of this year. You'll see some information about how to account for those situations. Go ahead.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa McKinley with Franklin County. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is actually Martha Rose Sapp. Lisa McKinley is my son's caseworker, and I'm listening in on this conversation. And my question, I do have the system in our house, and we're going to be working with two different agencies. We're going to have a nursing agency who is going to be using this, as well as an agency that provides homemaker personal care services. And our nursing agency is really pushing people to use their phones, which I was told would require a signature from me as my son's guardian. My question is, I've told the agency I want to use the EEV device. Does the EEV device require me to do a signature after the employees clock in and out?
That is a question that is more specific to the state. It depends on how they're requiring it. If they're requiring electronic signature from the guardian, if they're requiring it from the individual when the guardian isn't present, states would have to have a policy or process for how to deal with that, and I really can't answer for your specific state.
So then I should check with the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
That to see if that the EEV require a signature from me as well.
Yeah, I would check with your state to see what they are going to require, definitely.
And then my other question, like to kind of piggyback that, like if somebody clocks in late, because my son has 24-hour care, that's going to be monitored, because my other question was, is that going to, like, alert somebody to the fact that this caregiver clocked in late? Do you understand what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Sure. And it may. One of the things that an electronic or any kind of check-in system does is verifies the time when somebody comes in. So I would say, yes, that may catch late check-ins. I don't know who would be addressing it, whether it would be the provider.
Probably the different. I'm assuming the two different agencies are providing services.
Uh-huh.
And then my last thing is,
I have powered up, and
it's saying 4G.
That would be something where you definitely have to go back to the state and ask that question of the state.
So is that because so it could possibly
because it could
possibly
it's
a and maybe it's
and maybe it's the agent
going to be billed for that.
It sounds like you've got some questions about the actual technology, and then some questions about how the how some real life events are going to be treated under the system. You know, going back to your question about if your personal care provider is late, you know, that can be for any number of reasons. They were stuck in traffic, they got held up at another location. All of those could be perfectly legitimate. And so, what does it mean if the individual was supposed to be there at 1 o'clock and they signed in at 1:30, for example? You know, does that automatically, raise a red flag in the system? Is there an ability to say, you know, my worker was late for traffic congestion rather than my worker was late, you know, because he or she, you know, did not come on time? So those are all
because
kinds
they
of
were just late because they were late.
Correct. And so that could happen as well. And so is there an ability in the system to differentiate, you know, the reason why a visit was starting later than it was authorized? And I think those are all very relevant questions that your state will need to walk you through. We're just a little disadvantaged at the federal level, not understanding the specifics of Ohio's system.
Awesome. Thanks.
Your next question comes from Sheila Gunn-Cushman with EVV Stoppers. Your line is open.
Thank you. I think that the impression I'm getting based on the comments that have been made here on this call and those that we've heard in theme form is that not every state is as awesome as California in its attempt at communication with everybody. And even California, I'd like to see some things get better. And I see that there are a lot of people who are not understanding what's going on, despite their pretty good efforts to make it good. I'd also like to echo the electrochemical sensitivity stuff and the fact that some people just can't have that equipment around them and therefore don't. And the comment about rural areas. But I would like to bring something else to your attention as well, which is that as a result of these EVV systems going into place, someone is going to have to train the workers, someone is going to have to train the recipients and or their, family helpers or whatever that help them understand these systems. And I'm a recipient myself, and so I would have to get the training, but I'm blind. And so are things going to be accessible? And if you tell me to go back to my state, I'll be very unhappy because we have gone to California with these things. And I think a lot of these people are coming to you with these questions because the states aren't clear and they're flailing about. But when you start these EVV things, you are going to get some data, or some data is going to happen going to the state's departments of social services and the county departments of social services that say their recipients are losing workers because the workers are too frustrated, too overburdened, can't buy the equipment. Maybe they don't want to take responsibility for equipment they're not going to own. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts there. And I want that data monitored where if a recipient had a worker before EVV and they lose that worker, why was that worker lost? How was that worker lost? And then I want that recipient to be able to get help getting a new worker. And that is partially the responsibility of the state, but since the feds are foisting this down our throats, it's the feds' responsibility as well. And I would like to see that data collated. The last thing, I'm trying to be fast, I'm sorry, is that we need to have the, damn it, I lost it. Okay, well, I'll find the box. But one more thing that you guys should know is that I was on hold for 10 minutes before I even got to your operators to get into the call. And so I was 13 minutes late to your thing, and I started 4 minutes before the I started 1 minute before the meeting would have begun. And so I missed 13 minutes of your meeting trying to get in. And so you're going to have to ask this conference company to have more operators ready for this call when people are coming in. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Chris Montrell with Shands Home Care. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. We're seeking clarification on the start date of EVV here in Florida. ACA has told us that EVV already went into effect as of October 1st, which is different from, you know, CMS and the federal information that we've seen. So can you clarify that for us?
First, I'll say that we're going to go back to the other call as soon as this is over and respond there. But in response to your call, EVV, the federal requirement for EVV for personal care services, is January 1st, 2020. There is a good faith effort exception that if a state is granted, could take them to January 1st of 2021. That does not, there is nothing in this statute that prohibits a state from implementing EVV earlier. So with regard to whether or not Florida has done an early implementation, I don't have knowledge of that. It is a question that you certainly could send to the mailbox. You're saying that you've already asked the state, so I would send it to the mailbox, and we will do follow-up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to the previous caller, we recognize that there were difficulties with individuals getting in. There often is when we have a large number of individuals calling in. We delayed the call by 5 minutes to account for some of that. Clearly, we did not capture all of it. So if you came in 15 minutes late, you missed 10 minutes of the call. We do have an electronic encore presentation that you can get for the next 2 days that will give you, you can listen, it's audio, so you can listen to the first 10 minutes. It was not a Q&A, it was introduction. So I think you will be able to capture that information fairly easily. There will also be transcripts available. So we've taken into account as well as we can the difficulties with doing anything like this on such a large basis. With regard to the other concerns you had, some of them or all of them you can send into the mailbox. Again, I would have to tell you that we are working to get out national information where it makes sense and would be consistent across state systems. Where it will not be consistent across state systems, or where there is latitude for a state to determine how they will render the services or the system, we would defer to the state to make that determination. So that is the best answer I can give you with regard to the concerns that you've expressed.
Your next question comes from the line of Denise D'Souza with Unified Community. Your line is open.
Hi. My question to you is when I missed the date where companies that provide residential and day program for individuals with disability, when is the EVV will be implemented for those programs? And the other thing, I know you guys said you're going to have a transcript. Where would we get those so I can share that with our staff?
So this is Melissa, and I'll answer the first part of the question. So the start date for EVV for Medicaid-funded personal care is January 1, 2020, unless the state has received a good faith effort, which would delay the implementation by another 12 months, making it January 1, 2021. You mentioned day services, and I will caveat that by saying it's not a foregone conclusion that EVV will be applicable to the services provided by day service providers. The congressional requirement is that EVV apply to personal care services that require an in-home visit, and in our prior guidance, we've defined an in-home visit to include those instances in which a personal care visit either starts or ends in the home and may continue into the community. And so depending on individual circumstances, that could encompass personal care services provided in non-residential settings, but it's not automatically guaranteed to. So as a provider of day services, you'll want to have a conversation with your state to figure out the likelihood of EVV being applied to services that are provided when someone is at your non-residential provider, and so you'll understand the logistics of that. I am going to ask Jill to give the logistical information for where you can access the transcript after today's call.
So today's I'm sorry, just one thing.
Ask before you do the
When you talk about personal care,
does that also mean the residential with a company or just families, personal?
You're breaking up, but what I would say to you, and I hope this clarifies it, is that the Cures Act talks about electronic visit verification for personal care services that require an in-home visit. So it would be a visit to the individual's residence. I don't know.
But private? Or with a company?
Could be either.
Okay.
Jill, can you give the contact?
Sure. So the transcript for today will be available. We have a podcast and transcript webpage. That link is on the announcement that was sent out. So you give us some time to get it posted because we'll have to go through and make edits just as far as spelling goes. And so that link is on the announcement that was sent out.
All right, thank you.
Your next question comes from Michael Kassab with M&R Home Assistance. Your line is open.
Hi, I have a few concerns regarding non-English speaking or reading caregivers that I have. So are they working on some kind of workaround for those who wouldn't necessarily be able to get into an app, put in like a username or password, and, you know, enter in the services that were done, especially here in Michigan? When they're pushing for $15 an hour minimum wage, it's that much harder to find caregivers at $10 an hour, let's say. So most of them end up being non-English speaking. So are there any kind of solutions around that?
I think one of the reasons that the CHORES Act calls for stakeholder involvement and that CMS has emphasized it is for issues exactly like this, where the state needs to troubleshoot up front where they're going to have problems in their system. It's one of the reasons that piloting the program within the time frames allowed was also suggested, so that you could control for those things. Where individuals have communication difficulties, clearly the EVV system is going to have to address those difficulties. And it is one of the primary reasons for stakeholder involvement. There isn't a standard answer for that nationally. I think different systems have addressed it differently, as have different states. But I, again, urge you to be talking to Michigan regarding this concern because, quite frankly, the state doesn't want to be hit at the end of the period where they say they are fully aligned with the fact that they've left out a complete population of individuals from the process.
Your next question comes from the line of Donna Cully with Southwestern Behavior. Your line is open.
Thank you. Do you know if CMS has any plans going forward to apply the EVV requirements to providers who are providing behavioral or mental health care services in home environments?
Whether or not those services include services with ADLs and IADLs. So if that service is bundled with a personal care aspect to the service, it may be swept into EVV, but CMS is making no plans at this point to expand EVV beyond what is required in the CARES Act, which is personal care services and home health care services.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Adorno with California Associates. Your line is open.
Yes, if a state chooses to go beyond the CARES Act and implement this for hospice services, wouldn't that require a regulatory or state statute change?
It may in your state. I don't know what the state's regulations and statutes read on that matter, but it certainly may. I wouldn't be able to speak to that at a federal level. but it certainly is something I would be speaking to my state about if I knew that there was intent to do that.
Okay, so am I clear that it's
only for
Medicaid services, health, and personal care?
Yes.
That's what the Cures Act requires.
Thank you.
For services that are rendered as part of an in-home visit.
That's it. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Julie Espinoza with Reach of Plano. Your line is open.
Yes. We're at a Center for Independent Living, and we have a question from Annie Wallace.
My question is, who wants this other than the people who are going to be paid to set up this whole EVE process? I haven't found any persons with disabilities, or as I like to say, possibilities like myself, I'm legally blind, that actually want this service implemented, other than the people who are going to be paid to set up the services. And couldn't the money be used to give better services instead of setting up another monitoring program? Because our government already has so many different monitoring programs that just hold up the services from being given properly. So who actually wants this EVV program?
The honest answer that we can give you is that Congress has required it through statute, and we are required to implement the desires of Congress. Beyond that, I can't tell you who wanted it, who requested it. That information is beyond my purview or our purview here. Melissa?
You know, the only other thing I would add, in not speaking for Congress, and this is, you know, we don't know what was necessarily in their minds, but there are some program integrity nuances to any type of system that will verify that visits that are being billed actually happened. And so we understand and respect all of the concerns and the questions that are associated with implementation and the wording of the actual Cures Act legislation. Philosophically, you know, the use of a system to make sure that services that are being billed actually provided or were actually provided, you know, is understandable. There is a lot of money associated with the provision of personal care in the Medicaid program across the country. If you look at some of the audits of programs that have been done in the past, you will find some instances of bills being generated for services that were not provided. And so there is something to be said for the implementation of a system that makes sure that to the extent the state is being billed for services and then seeking federal reimbursement for those services, that there was documentation that they were actually provided. Again, that's speaking at a very high level philosophically for the support that EVB may have had as it was being developed for legislation. But the philosophy aside, understanding how the language of the legislation will implement the actual provision of care on the ground and the real life concerns of individuals who are going to be using EVV systems is critical for us to hear to figure out what we can do at the federal level to the extent there are things we can do given the statutory construct. So that's an answer based on the best of our abilities. You know, without having any drafters of the legislation on the phone, so that's about, you know, I will say on that.
Next question, please.
Your next question comes from Colleen Swartz with MassHealth. Your line is open.
Thank you. Can you clarify how penalties for noncompliance with EBV requirements will be assessed?
So in the statute, there are some requirements for a withhold of federal reimbursement for personal care services or home health services, and that withhold is discussed in the statute at certain amounts at certain times, and so that would be based on a state that was not in compliance with EBV and does not have an approved good faith effort that would give a state an additional 12 months. So, for example, the personal care requirements for EBV kick in January 1, 2020. And so if a state did not have a good faith effort approved by CMS, CMS would need to start withholding a percentage of federal reimbursement for your personal care claims based on the numerical figures outlined in the statute. If the state did have a good faith effort, that would give the state another 12 months until January 1, 2021, to avoid any kind of federal penalties. So it's the financial implications are spelled out in the statute, and they go, you know, by fiscal year, and there are some figures associated with them. We've been doing our best to figure out, to the extent any of those penalties need to be effectuated, how we can do them based on the nuances of that particular state. So, for example, personal care can be provided in many different ways, and it could be that there is one program that is in compliance in a state, another program that is not. How can CMS best effectuate any kind of financial penalty as close to a specific program that is non-compliance as possible? In some cases, that will require some ongoing discussion with the state, and it will be specific based on the state's use of various authorities. But our goal is to be as precise as possible when effectuating any kind of financial withhold. But that will depend a lot on the variables of how that state authorizes personal care.
With regard to the specific withholds, in 2020, it is a 0.25%. In 2021, it is 0.5%. In 2022, it is 0.75%. After that, it is 1%. That 1% does not continue to add on, moving to 2 or 3. It is 1% in perpetuity until the state comes into compliance, and that is effectuated by quarter. So a state could be out of compliance for the first quarter of 2020, come into compliance the second quarter, and that penalty would only exist for the first quarter. CMS is currently in the process of building a system where states can report their compliance so that we can do the proper assessment.
Thank you. I have a separate question. We actually have a series of questions we submitted to determine if EBV was applicable to certain services. We heard your response earlier that because states have different definitions for different services, that you weren't going to respond to those questions in this forum, and that's understandable. How can we get those questions answered?
Well, your first step would be to go to your state, but you certainly could send the question in to the mailbox, or if you are the state itself, reach out to your CMS regional analyst or contact, and they'll arrange a meeting with CMS writ large, both central office and the regional office. So I would say your two specific options would be the mailbox and or requesting a meeting be scheduled. We're amenable to either or both.
Okay. And then a final question. After January 1st, 2020, if we need to certify a new provider for to improve an access issue, is there a grace period that would be allowed for those providers to become compliant with EVV requirements, or do they need to be compliant?
Do they need to be compliant as soon as they provide services?
What I would say to you is this. I think that the best way to deal with that is for the state to set up an internal policy and procedure that says how that new entity will demonstrate compliance with EVV. You might want to take a look at your error rates, again, that you used when you started the system, or your exceptions process, and determine how that factors in here.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Larry Wanninger with Southern Indiana Resource Solutions. Your line is open.
Thank you. Actually, this is Kelly Mitchell. Larry and I are here together. I believe you answered my first clarification. It's my understanding that the federal EVV mandate applies only to in-home services, personal care or home health care provided in the home, and not community-based services or group congregate day services. But I do have one other question, and I'm not certain that you can respond, but does the mandate allow an error or exception if a provider would have a caregiver who may forget to clock in or clock out, if you will, at the home base using the EVV system? Under Department of Labor, the provider has to pay the individual for services rendered, regardless of whether they use the EVV system. Is the provider going to be penalized and not paid and yet liable for paying wages? How would that work?
How would that work?
First, I would urge you to speak with your state representative specifically about this. Second, I would say that we've spoken about error rates and exception processes that could be put in place. I think that when I say exception processes, I want to be clear, though, that exception processes would mean that it was an exception and not the rule, that you had somebody who habitually didn't sign in or habitually didn't sign out, but rather there was an exception error rate process. And that I would be talking directly with my state about, because that's where it's going to be critical for you to have that information and to have that information clean and clear.
Okay.
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 Thank you.
Sir.
Your next question comes from Mary Anderson with Able Inc. Your line is open.
Thank you. I think my questions have been answered also, and I appreciate the comment that was made earlier by one of your staff that it would be very nice to see the origination of the rule. So if it's a CMS rule, if it's a state rule, because we do find that the ball keeps bouncing back and forth between the state saying it's CMS and CMS, we have no access to you to verify. So I really want to strongly emphasize that is transparent and clear to us so that we do get answers. And I think, you know, I originally asked the question about congregate care, like what is the definition? And I think that's also where the nuanced conversation came up. Am I correct?
Yes, understood. And your concerns are understood and acknowledged. One of the things I would tell you is, again, use the EVV mailbox. We do respond to that. You will get a written response from CMS if you have specific questions that you need answered. The other thing I want to do in clarification for the previous caller was to ensure that it's an in-home visit. An in-home visit is defined currently as a visit that either occurs entirely in the home and or starts in the home or ends in the home. So there may be some community activity included in there. I don't want you thinking that it was completely left out. We did cover that at the beginning of the meeting. but definitely you can get straight answers from, you can get answers from CMS, and I'm not implying that you're not getting straight answers from the state. That was just very poorly worded, and I apologize for that. You can get answers from CMS if you write to the EBV mailbox.
Thank you.
And this is Melissa. And you can also take a look at the two pieces of guidance that we issued over the summer, the informational bulletin and the FAQs. You know, that's really the bulk of the formal guidance CMS has written. And you can see where we have attempted to provide some language at the federal level to ensure all stakeholders, including states, have a level playing field about federal expectations. And then we're also pretty explicit in other places where the state will be making decisions, for example, on the type of system to select, the type of technology that system will require, the types of training that both providers and individuals and their families will need to take to understand the mechanics of their implementation efforts. And so that kind of at a 30,000-foot level lays out who is in charge of making what decisions. But we understand that does not provide clarity to the universe of scenarios that you'll be encountering. So that mailbox really is, the EBV mailbox is a direct link to CMS, and we've been appreciative of our ability to then have direct communications with a wider array of stakeholders than we typically have. And so we can verify something for you if you're hearing it, and want to make sure that it's on our radar screen or that you're hearing from us about, the origin of a particular decision. We're happy to use that forum. And then, we're happy to keep the lines of communication open.
I would also say, just as a resource, look at the informational bulletin that was published in May of 2018 that references the states that currently have EBV services standing up already. You may have resources in those states with regard to agencies that you're aligned with that can also give you information and assist you as you're trying to understand the impact.
Your next question comes from the line of Ruth Ann Sikora from Parent. Your line is open.
Thank you. I want to say I really appreciate you having this conversation with us, considering this piece of legislation came out of finance and commerce, and I'm not sure how much they really do know about how this impacts families, caregivers, the individuals with the disabilities, all the way around. I have a couple of questions, and I will try to ask them before that they're answered. I really would like to know what these, it was brought up earlier, these six data points that they're looking for this information to come in to answer the data that they're looking for in regards to these six data points. And then I was also trying to find the six data points on myself, and I found this website called policyhealth.gov legislative, and it goes on, and it was talking about who that they're really targeting when they're talking about the workers. And it specifically says that a home care agency employee provided the agreed upon point of care. So that when we were talking about that kind of gray area, when we were asking about the family member providing direct care for their family member within their home, so they really never come to the home and leave the home. It's always from the home, so they're not coming to the home and then leaving. They're always there. This specifically says the target was that a home care agency employee that has a point, and it also goes on to say that they call their agency and report this information. Well, a family member does not have an agency that hires us and then reports to that agency. Now, we do have timesheets that are filled out, and there was also something else that maybe is not information that this committee was aware of, but we are visited on a fairly frequent basis by case managers that fill out reports. The transparency is there to give them information about what is going on in the individual's life, in the family's life, and that's on a regular basis, and that's mandated by CMS. So, you know, when we have that gray area, and I would like to ask when they're talking about this, if this is correct, and they're talking about agency employees, then some clarification needs to take place because the legislation does not specify that, but the background does specify that. And if there needs to be a waiver that's built into this legislation, then maybe we need to go back to this committee and ask them to address that specific issue, because it does say family caregivers, but the background says agency employees. So the six data points is very important in what they're looking for, and the fact that there's...
Okay.
Could you give us that website address one more time?
It's https://policy.house.
I think you're cutting out, so I think I would ask you to send that link to the mailbox.
Yes, thank you. That would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, we'll take a look at that. You know, meanwhile, the six data points that we're talking about are those that are referenced in the Cures legislation as needing to be captured for each visit in which personal care is delivered in the home. And so those are the name of the individual receiving the service, the name of the individual providing the service, the type of service. So is it personal care or home health? The location of service delivery, the start and stop time of the service, and the date of service. And you can find that you know, laid out directly in the Cures Act legislation.
If you look at section 12006, you'll find the information there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. You're breaking up again. So, but please do follow up with that web address through the mailbox, and we'll take a look at it. Thanks.
Your next question comes from TK Small with Concepts of Independence. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a two-part question. One, as it relates to the interpretation of HIPAA compliance. If HIPAA is a federal law, why is CMS directing people to look at state resources on interpretation of HIPAA compliance? And then I'm really also very concerned about accessibility of these EVV systems. I'm a severely disabled quadriplegic due to spinal muscular atrophy. The technology I use to access my phone and internet and email services is very specific to me. But also, many PAs, many personal assistants in the Consumer Directed Program have hidden disabilities like mental health issues and learning disabilities. Of the six people that work for me, I would say that four of them are going to have great trouble navigating a complicated EVV system. Can you speak to those two issues?
Yeah, this is Melissa. And so I would say that
we acknowledge those concerns and understand where they're coming from. Ralph had given an answer a couple questions ago when similar concerns were being raised about individuals who with limited English proficiency and how would they be able to access the technology. And so any kind of, there's any number of variables on that theme. How would individuals, you know, with other kinds of needs be taken into account as the state is rolling out their system? And so, you know, about the only thing we can do is to reiterate the how critical that stakeholder engagement is between you as a person who is receiving Medicaid services and the state as they are making implementation decisions. We can certainly reiterate to states the expectation that the systems are rolled out in such a way and the training is conveyed in such a way as to accommodate the needs of individuals, be it the ones who are working the technology from the service provider angle and from the beneficiary angle. But that's only going to be made more clear by you and your viewpoints directly to the state. So we would encourage, you know, to the extent that you know that you have not had a conversation with your providers, who will be the people who are introducing the technology to you and your state, to do so. And we can, you know, if you need some help in facilitating that, we can certainly do that. On the HIPAA requirements, I mean, there is a provision in the Cures Act that says that the requirements of HIPAA need to be protected. There are federal requirements that lay out HIPAA specifications, and then there are also some state specifications. In some cases, states are authorized to release personally identifying information based on the parameters of different laws. And CMS is not the purveyor of all of those different types of privacy laws. And so it's kind of a joint responsibility between CMS and the state to make sure that provisions of HIPAA are being met. You know, because the transmission of the information collected from EVV will be happening between a state government and the federal government, you know, kind of structurally that kind of data transmission is permissible under HIPAA, but there are requirements that you know can get very technical very quickly that we are not expert in here. And so it's as much of a state responsibility as a federal responsibility to make sure that everybody understands the proper use of the data that's collected through the EVV system and the need to treat that, you know, with the through the lens of privacy that HIPAA brings to the table. But it is not necessarily an issue that, you know, that solely rests, you know, with us or with the state. So, you know, it's a work in progress to make sure we and the states are on the right side of HIPAA as this moves forward.
And your state HIPAA compliance officer answers to the Office of Civil Rights with regard to the enforcement of HIPAA. So it's not that there isn't a federal arm extended, but the more intimate and the more immediate response you can get is from your state HIPAA compliance officer, which is part of the expectation of enforcement of HIPAA.
Is it fair to say that CMS will be continuing to watch the situation, and if consumers raise concerns that state HIPAA compliance officers are not being responsive, that CMS would then step in and possibly provide some additional guidance to state HIPAA compliance officers?
We will follow up regarding concerns that are expressed to us. HIPAA compliance does fall under the purview of the Office of Civil Rights, so I wouldn't necessarily commit that CMS will be the federal partner that is doing follow-up, but I will tell you that we certainly would not turn a deaf ear to issues that were being brought to us. And with
that,
repurposed military surplus
technology equipment was used, which has been fairly well documented as not being secure.
As not being.
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate that.
Our next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Joe Beaver, private investor. Your line is open. Joe Beaver, your line is open.
Hi. My concern is regarding privacy. I used an agency for 12 years that used telephony, which I assume is what you're looking at for a CV or EVV system. The last 2 years, I've been on CDOS, and we just fill out paperwork, which is really pretty simple. Whenever we were using the telephony, first of all, it's time-consuming for the aide that's coming in to clock in with that, with all of his identification numbers and so on. It was set up using my cell phone, so that's how they verify location, is by my phone number. After he performs his services, then he goes to clock out, and he clocks out without me being able to see how he's really responding to the questions that are being asked. And I know that he's just punching yes on everything. So that's really inaccurate and not valuable at all. I don't even know who gets the information. But there's really too much detail. They're asking such private matters as bowel movement. Not only did I have a bowel movement, what size was the bowel movement? Who cares? None of that goes to my doctor. That's just the ridiculous kind of privacy information that's being started. Well, whenever I switched over to CDOS, the state does a complete examination on me as to what my needs are, and they set the allocation. I have consistently been under the allocation because the aides that I have hired are very efficient. They don't just sit and wait to do one task and then do the other. They multitask. If I'm sitting on the toilet, well, maybe they're cleaning house or fixing breakfast. So I really don't understand why, in the first place, that we have to support information as long as I'm under the budget, which the state had already said that you're allowed this much allocation. So under the CDOS program, two of us signed the timesheet. So I'm verifying the time that they spent. And they don't ask anything about the size of my bowel movement. They ask personal care, homemaker, and health maintenance. And we divide those between their time between those three sections. And if I am the employer, as described in my CDOS application, I should really have some sense control over what's input. Under the EBV, I do not. So that's really my comment. And my question is, why is it necessary? I think one of the questions asked previously is, who invented this idea in the first place? It really makes me think that the only ones who are benefiting from this are the manufacturers of the EBV system. And that's my comment.
Yep. Thanks for that. And your point about, you know, your services being consistently under the allotment of care that the, or allotment of funds that the state has given for the provision of your services is well taken. You know, and that, you know, goes back to what I mentioned earlier. This is Melissa about the program integrity basis of EBV. So I understand that that's certainly before the advent of EBV, there was still a program integrity paradigm that overlaid all of Medicaid services, and there were checks and balances in the mix to make sure that states had some certainty with regard to their budgeting and the amount of services and supports that were authorized for individuals were based on assessed needs. And so you're absolutely correct. This is, the advent of another way to check to make sure that the services that are being billed were actually provided. As to the content of the types of questions that your personal care worker would need to answer, that's going to be specific to the actual system that your state selects. And so the only pieces of information that are required to be collected are those six data points about the type of service, like personal care, the date of the service, your identity, your worker's identity, the location of the service, things like that. And so from our perspective at the federal level, that's the universe of information that needs to be captured. It will depend on the actual model and system selected by the state as to whether there is any additional information besides those six data points. But we understand the need to make it, as concise as possible to convey validity of the service without, requiring a lot of narrative description about the types of services that happened and et cetera. So your points are well taken. And you may want to follow up, with your provider and with your state, to get your specific questions answered on that particular model. So we need to do a time check. It's 3:00 Eastern time. And so that brings us to the end of our call. We know that we've got still some questions in the queue, and we apologize for not being able to get to those. We remind you that the mailbox is still available as a resource. And so please, if you've got a question that has not been addressed, please submit it to our mailbox, and we will do our best to get you a response as quickly as possible. Again, that mailbox is edv@cms.hhs.gov. And a reminder that if you already submitted feedback into the mailbox in advance of today's call and you do want a formal and individual response, please resubmit it, and we will go from there. Again, appreciate your patience, as it might take us a few days to work through all of these incoming emails. We do really appreciate your participation today, and this will not be the end of our conversations. We will take this feedback into account as we determine what the next steps are. Look at the announcement for today's call for the logistical information for how to access the audio playback and the transcript for today's meeting. And I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up, unless anybody here has any final thoughts.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for participating in today's electronic visits verification EVV stakeholder open door forum conference call. This call will be available for replay beginning at November 7th at 5:00 p.m. until November 9th at midnight. The conference ID number for the replay is 3397-9177. The number to dial for the replay is 855-859-2056. Again, this replay will be available beginning at 5:00 p.m. November 7th until midnight November 9th, and the conference ID is 3397-9177, and the number to dial for the replay is 855-859-2056. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.